All right, so let me ask you, Frank.
Yeah.
We don't have to, this doesn't necessarily have to be a thing, but I know you had a situation the other day in your group of people,
yeah.
sort of, you know, some drama erupted there.
Yeah.
Now, if you want, we can actually go into that, but I guess I want to get to this idea of kind of bring this back to, there's such hardline positions one way or the other.
Yeah.
That people have forgotten any and all subtlety or shades of gray.
Yeah.
So you have people who say it's all a government conspiracy or it's all love and light and there is, you know, there's no conspiracy. Everyone's looking out for your best interest, blah, blah, blah. Then you have, from an esoteric perspective, you have the people who say, you know, all in and everything is, you know, like hardcore ritual, which I think is probably a minority. But the prevailing majority right now is this religious concept that everything esoteric is somehow bad.
Yeah, that roots really in, well, I mean, all kind of stuff, but the modern wave we're seeing of that is an offshoot of people like Fritz Springmeier.
Yes, yes.
So what he did was, he's got this terribly, terribly amount of detailed data about the methodology and the functioning of mind control, mostly trauma-based, mind control-based, the way they instill these alters, the way they go back to Goetia and these ancient techniques of mind controlling people or possessing people or transdimensional stargazing, just whatever. And then he updates it to all this modern knowledge where he's going through the individual types of programs and alters that would function in today's world. We could see them clearly in the entertainment business and the military and things like this, except every other sentence is Jesus or Satan. So his understanding of esotericism is only the extreme breakdown of all these occult techniques, which run over the same kind of terminology that just Western occult tradition does. But that led everybody after him to think that all of these occult books, everyone from Elias Tripoli to Madame Blavatsky, everyone responsible for any mystical train of thought was somehow practicing Satanism. Then the minute you get into anybody with serpents crawling up their spine in the age-old human tradition of Kundalini yoga or anything like that, these people are saying, wait, serpents in your spine, these must be the Satan worshippers or whatever. And so the data got so confused, especially in the 90s when all these victims come out and they hear Fritz Springmeier's stuff and there's a couple of other flagship people leading them in the wrong direction, and then all of a sudden just everything occult to Satanism, all rap, you know, music video makers, all rap music videos are definitely an Illuminati ritual, you know, and all this kind of stuff. Just got, and Vigilant Citizen did not do any help taking all of this media and just throwing it directly towards Satan and just having no, I mean, seemingly no really deep occult knowledge without copying off of other writers and bloggers and then twisting it to Satan that I can find. And so I don't blame Fritz because the man seemed like he was really, really troubled and he was trying to get this data out like he did think somebody was going to hurt him. And of course, that's a sales technique in the conspiracy world, but it seems it was so much data that people still haven't paid attention to that I think his work is really worth looking into, at least to understand the methodology. Like I say, it's nowhere else. Once all the mind control data gets physically burnt, you know, in the 60s and 70s and stuff, by the 50s and 70s, like I was saying in the last interview, we had trauma-based mind control and electronic means mastered. And now in the modern theater, you only have Alex Jones re-preaching parts of Fritz Springmeier, Michael Sarion, and whatever. And then way across the board, you have these bloggers and these victims that are desperate for people to speak for them, that are, you know, they may be disinformation agents themselves. I don't know. But I've been through so many of these different cases where people are saying, yes, I've been through this. I don't know exactly details that happened, but whatever. Here's the things in common with all the other trauma-based mind control or super soldier or alien abductees, and it bleeds right into each other. I'm sorry, that was a ramble fest and a half.
Pierre, did you guys, you've seen this researcher, a guy that gives like lectures, oh here it is, William Schoenbellen? Schnoebellen or something? He looks like the guy from Jaws and like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, whatever that actor's name is.
white hair or whatever, the wolf guy.
Yeah, well, he was in a vampire cult or something.
What's his name?
William Schnabelin. S-C-H-N-O-E-B-L-E-N.
I can listen to you say that name all day.
Yeah. He always gives these lectures where he's like a 99 degree warlock in the Illuminati, and he was in a vampire.
Oh yeah, I saw that guy.
One of those guys.
And he's everything begins and ends with praise God and praise Jesus, and I was a 99 degree warlock in the Illuminati, praise Jesus, you know.
Yeah. I like how it says here on Wikipedia that he's an American messianic Christian apologist.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry about that, guys. I know we're responsible for more bloodshed than any group in the history of the world, but I'm sorry.
You'll find that these guys will switch what they're super, super into or who's backing them and try to act like nothing changed because they're just on the same speaking circuit. But, like, they'll go from thinking they were this abused person and the super soldier person and the super gifted psychic to just this terrible person who gets hit with psychotronics whenever they're just trying to make a sandwich or whatever. And with the people who actually sell the books, like I'm saying, they go at each other's throats and contradict little parts of it seemingly to sell their own stuff.
Now, can I just throw one little thing in there? Is to say, as a guy who, as of recently, is technically one of those guys, right? We're doing the sync book and stuff like that. I'd like to think that I'm still a small enough fish that I get to be honest, but you know, I do think there's room to disagree. Like what I've noticed is that within our sync community is. There's a tendency to resist any kind of debate or, you know, hey, well, I see it this way, you see it this way, let's talk about that. There's a tendency to shy away from that. And
yeah,
I think,
it's beautiful.
Say that again?
It's beautiful. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, is it... I guess what I was trying to say is there should be... It's beautiful that people don't want to jump at each other's throats. And yet, I think there's room for healthy debate. And I'm just saying, as a guy who's trying to promote the idea of maybe there should be a little more debate in this field, is not to stir up controversy to sell books, but because we don't want to be an echo chamber either. You know, I think it's healthy to say, hey, you know, what's the deal with Fritz Springmeier and everyone aping his take on it. I think that's a really dangerous thing. We have one source and everyone is just repeating this one source. I think that's really dangerous. So to have some of these debates and then even, you know, I said within a more specialized sync field of someone saying, hey, I think this is all beautiful. I think this is all programming. You know, there should be room for debate there. That wasn't really aimed at Just to say, I think we need to put that caveat out there, is that I still think healthy debate is important, particularly for an area, for areas where a lot of times people start to have a tendency to kind of take other people's words for it, or repeat information. You know, there's only so much that everyone, I encourage everyone to study things themselves, but once you get to the point where all right, someone quoted this book, and or they're telling me this book is about this, and okay, that's your understanding of it. Yeah. Ultimately, once you go and read it for yourself and then go, wait, that's not what I got out of it, you know?
Right. So I saw on Netflix recently that Zeitgeist is on Netflix, and while wow, Zeitgeist blew the fuck up, but what's crazy is like that whole first section with religion is based off of this guy looked at a book called The Christ Conspiracy, written by this woman who has like this Sanskrit name, and she got everything from Albert Pike. Like, there's no like for like explanation that she can give beyond Albert Pike. And it's funny because like those guys didn't like they read that book and were like, all right, this is awesome, and they included it all like as a matter of fact. And it's really unfortunate because once again, there's some gems in there, but then most of it is fucking bogus. If you guys can find a source of any of that beyond Albert Pike, you can get money for it with a website called the Zeitgeist Challenge. These people like have been offering money like shortly after the documentary came out to anyone who can prove like a huge list of things that are stated at the beginning of that. But it's just, it's funny, like people didn't bother to cross-reference any of that, like, and now it's on fucking Netflix. Like, what a trip. Like,
I've read the Christ conspiracy, and interesting how that theory that Jesus is based off of Horus and all the other, these other characters was used in Religious by Bill Maher, and pretty sure, you know, like Bill Maher would be the type that would sort of like, I don't know, poo-poo the category like the genre Zacharias is in. He's like, yeah, so like just taking the bits he would like.
Well, at the end of I'm sorry, Trevor.
Oh no, go ahead.
I was just gonna say that it's very telling when Bill Maher has David Icke at the end of Religious, and you can really build a respect for David Icke around that, and a disrespect for Bill Maher, because he essentially just steps to him and he's like, "Oh, you believe reptilian shapeshifters control all the politicians and the whole world government, and they're space people." You know, and David Icke, in the most reasonable response probably ever heard of. This is also a guy who went on national television and thought he, you know, 30 years earlier, thought he was contacted by, you know, God to give the message of the world, whatever. And he just looks at him like really, really bravely, kind of looks down at him. And he's like, look, mate, you can take me in front of any, you know, place here in London or whatever and just rip apart my or anyone else's philosophy. But, you know, I invite you to do the research yourself or whatever. And I'm not saying David Icke's a hero or anything, but I thought that moment was really meaningful. In a trans ramble, Alan, I just wanted to answer your question by saying that I think the best upper hand we have, or one of the things that gives us an upper hand in the Sync group as far as, like, relating information, where opinions are, and belief systems, is I think the belief systems are almost non-existent. There's so much information, the information's just going back and forth, and we all kind of know each other to the point where we know the information or the higher reasoning or feelings or whatever is the goal, so there's not a lot of bullshit fundamentalism in there, and it reminds me of the secret sun. And, you know, that's when the moon or the sun comes in conflict, because we're all people who just basically speak in information nonstop, and then you get these fundamentalist types who start insisting that magic is this or mind control is that.
Or that Aleister Crowley was a villain who wanted to rule the world.
right. The most, their favorite plot in that. One other thing. Oh yeah, I didn't want to let Fritz go out there and just drown alone. I wanted to say that I've run into tons and tons and tons of testimony, victim testimony, that seems related to the methodologies he's sharing, as to whether all these people are, you know, just looked up his book and decided to become a victim or whatever, because that's a common mental problem. I don't know. I just wanted to note that.
Well, we were talking about earlier with the jingles and how if you get a jingle stuck in your head, it'll be with you for the rest of your life. I just think that the dynamics of television or film or even literacy, when you program your brain to be able to interpret that information and be able to digest it, to be able to sit in front of a screen or sit in front of a book and then get the same thing out of it as another person, or at least 80% out of it as another person, that is a transformation of your neurological circuits, right? It's like riding a bike. You never forget how. But maybe there's a certain experience where your brain feels forced to disentangle itself from everything. And if that includes literacy or the ability to process visual information, that's when you get these really freaky, unexplainable blind spots, because it's a reversal. And I think that's what Valis is all about with Philip K. Dick, is it's an intense disentangling with all of the ways that your brain has been shaped. And in the process of doing that, in the gap, all this other information floods in. And And then it's coming to terms with what that information was, because usually it's translated as an actual experience. So for the UFO thing, you know, I believe UFO contactees and abductees. I mean, I believe they experienced what they say, but I don't necessarily believe that UFOs exist. If I'm going to stick with the I believe in nothing, that's a real difficult kind of crossroads for me.
Are you a nihilist, Bill? We believe in nothing, Lebowski.
But you know, just the whole self-defense of Robert Anton Wilson, which he opens Cosmic Trigger with.
Yeah.
You know, the Crowley quote. It's so fundamental. There's a word, right? To this work, yeah. And I think it was even stated by someone earlier in this call that ultimately I believe in nothing. But yet I can believe a person's experience. There seems to be a breakdown of either language there or of giving full credence to a thought like that.
Well, you got to keep it in perspective, right? I mean, and that's alchemy, right? Where you have separate, coagulate, and reunite. Like, the separation and the coagulation is an essential process, but eventually things get reinstituted, and that doesn't have to be a bad thing. You just have to keep it in perspective. So it's like how much weight, like, you restate your assumptions. It's like Max and Pi. He repeatedly, like, restates his assumptions about the nature of the universe, but he's not necessarily tied to those assumptions to the degree that he's ready to, like, fight over them, because it's not a matter of that, you know. Beliefs are a relative thing, you know, and beliefs have their own value. It's just you can't, you know, go overboard with it.
Correct, yeah.
It is my firm belief that is a mistake to hold firm beliefs.
I think that there's a value in the like, there's something in the faculty of us to be able to recollect to be able to instill something within ourselves, and at least to, like, meditate on, like a sentence. Like, that's what mantra is, you know, and, like, mantra has, like, value, like, beyond just, like, oh, well, this is an ancient language, like, in our own fucking language. Like, when those mantras were created, they came out of, like, that was what it was. Like, that wasn't, like, an ancient thing at the time. Like, and how you relate to something. Like, if you need to hear something, you, like, affirmations work, you know, they're a very powerful thing. There's something that you're missing. You know, you say, I forgive everyone who has ever harmed me, even me, over and over again, you know, that's going to have some extraordinary effects. If you repeat Coca-Cola so many times in a posture, it's going to have some effects too, but they're going to be slightly different, you know.
I just wonder what the collective conscious or unconscious reason is for repeating the sort of experience that we could look at as words or little bits in time that's like abduction, that shows itself to be, like, funny and trickster-like, but evolves over centuries into different things, as Jacques Vallée and a million other people's work at Philip Glass, a million other people's work starts to point to. And if that's the unconscious, then in the same way with the movies, why do we need the end of the world to look like this, but still with floating cards and whatever? Why do we need our altered consciousness experiences, perhaps transcendent, to mostly have the same entities that don't seem to be related to religious text and whatever? How are we evolving our unconscious, I guess?
Well, I think, you know, I wonder if there isn't a tendency in there. Bill was mentioning earlier the idea of, you know, flying cars or free energy, or, you know, all these concepts. Do you really want that to just be unleashed into the world? You don't know what people are going to do with it. But I would argue, do you want that kept under wraps by the people who've proven time and time again they'll use, you know, violence and force and corruption for their own gain again and again and again? Do you want that technology in their hands, and do you trust them to dole it out as in a rational or in a way that's beneficial for humankind? I don't think so. So what I think sometimes what we see is our little false utopias, this idea of seeing this future society where it has flying cars but everything's destroyed, is maybe a realization within us is two prominent. I mean, one is the realization within us that it's not, our technology can't save us, but also the idea that we see our false utopias as the fragile things they are, and that maybe there's a tendency to want to break those ideals. It's the same way you're just saying, this goes full circle to holding a firm belief or not holding a firm belief, which is like, okay, once a society gets so ingrained in a belief, there's almost this need to break it back down. And this is where we get into really gray areas with when we talk in a certain language of, you know, breaking down the ego or breaking down these structures to try and reassess, this is where people start yelling MK Ultra and things like that. Now, I don't doubt that there is some overlap there, but I just think that's ultimately an expression of, you know, more so than a controlled thing, it's an expression of this need to kind of get outside of that utopia trap or this very rigid belief system trap.
Right. Well, I mean, no one wants to have a quote-unquote mental breakdown, so it would be a lot more interesting if you're interacting with these other things or untangling your mind in a PKD sense. I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, you know, you can take it apart. This is, as David said, that salve et coagula idea of taking it apart to assess it and put it back together in an intelligent and thoughtful manner. And if you don't, you might suffer a breakdown.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so lunacy has value in that way. It's just a temporary value, you know. Right. Like, it's okay to go a little crazy sometimes.
We all go a little crazy.
Yeah. Just have to be willing to endure a reintegration and come, you know, not to come back to reality, but because what is, that's a relative term, but at least, you know, look through things through a new eye, through
like
a new lens.
Fool's journey in the tarot when he's the hanged man and the world is turned upside down for him.
Yeah.
Or death, you know, death and resurrection is something new.
Which Doug actually, at the Sink Cabin, he laid out the major arcana in such a way where he was showing that you have the fool's journey on the upper world and then it comes back around into the lower world. And I realized something really cool. I'd have to lay it out again, but the Crowley deck, if you do that and you create this, like, basically a vesica with the cards, it's a really interesting effect, and I could see why it was that he switched the adjustment and strength or lust in the way he did. It totally played into it. It was, I'd have to lay it out again, but yeah, it was really cool.
That's on your website, man.
In my website, I have right now on my blog, I have an explanation that it begins with of the switching of the cards. But yeah, this is just like a few days ago. I just was experimenting with what Doug had showed me with the Crowley deck, and I just saw some really interesting results. I haven't posted anything about that yet necessarily, but you know, it kind of blew me away. It's like the equivalent of, like, I don't know how you pronounce it, the tarot tableau, I think, where they do the three layers and have the fool at the top. It's a similar premise. You're just laying out the arcana in such a way, but in this case, it's just like a circle where you have the upper world of the journey and then the lower world. So it's like the realm of the waking life and then the realm of the dream and how they reflect each other, which is like what you said about the hangman. It's very revealing there, and I find it very helpful, like, to consider the whole, like, Heath Ledger thing from that aspect. It's kind of spooky, but it's worth looking into, you know.
Oh, I see. So it's almost, it's the, that sort of Joseph Campbell hero's journey, and if the hangman is at the bottom, he's sort of coming, it's showing that it's the bottom part of that circle.
Yeah, that the two are mutually interdependent.
Yeah.
Equivalent in the underworld, that is its own reflection, but not necessarily the reflection that you might assume, but each reflection has something to reveal, which is kind of cool.
Now, David and I had this conversation, and I actually had showed him a graphic that I made, which was You know, there's a, it was a picture of an ibis staring into the abyss and a person with his head buried in the sand. And it was saying, you know, ultimately this idea of how there you can go this peering into the underworld, that hangman thing can actually be a very good thing, but you can get stuck there. I don't know why I felt the need to throw that out there, because I feel like I have to make a, you know, I see the hangman card as a very positive thing, very, very positive in my respect, in my opinion. It's this idea of, you know, getting that new perspective on things, very, very useful, but I do understand that people could get stuck there. It's like, you know, again, it's that's that head in the sand extreme.
Well, me and Alex, the Celtic Rebel, often talk about people getting stuck at the Alex Jones level of awakening or something.
Yeah.
You know, oh, wait, things aren't what they seem, and then they don't ever move on past the ramping.
Well, you got one guy handing all to you, then one day it's Bohemian Grove, and now I'm an expert on the occult, and the next day it's Predator Drones, oh, now I'm an expert on Black Ops, and so it seems like they're giving you the full range of, you know, global knowledge or whatever, and it's obviously pretty malinformed, or very specifically informed to just be, to taste bad.
Right, they get the illusion because they have little pieces of it. I do that in certain areas.
Yeah.
Inevitable. Okay. You read a book and you get into it, and then it's like you read a book on the subject. It doesn't make you an expert necessarily, you know. Right. But you read a lot of books, and then you got something.
Yeah, for sure.
So, Violator, you were talking about Alejandro Jodorowsky here, where he does the same thing with the Major Arcana. Actually, I read the first chunk of that book. I loved it. He's looking at Marseille, right. Tarot. And I can't remember if he actually did it with the over and underworld like that necessarily. I know he plays with the cards and all his combinations. The ultimate thing that he comes to, where he has the mandala that he lays out, that's basically a large swastika in a sense, is just fucking incredible. Like I laid that out on my floor, and I got the Marseille deck to do it, and it's really cool. But I don't know about that specifically necessarily. I'd have to take another look at it. But yeah, he's a fucking genius. Speaking of which, when there's a video of him taking a walk in Paris, I believe, with who were we just talking about? Return of Quetzalcoatl.
Pinchback.
Yeah, he's like walking with Pinchback, and he just fucking schools him. It's so awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen like, that.
Pinchback just like talking about this date and his. To it, he's like, well, that doesn't seem like that's quite enough time if we need
I'd like to ask Bill. I mean, I know you're a fan of the Time Wave Zero, as am I. I really like it as a concept, but are you married to the date?
No, because I think that, you know, the time wave, it's that whole concept, if it happens, it's going to happen at some point today. It's happening all the time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It, but in order to get into it the first time, you have to entertain the reality or its linearity. That's the only way to learn it, and that's why it's such a dangerous, dangerous thing to learn, is because you can get lost in those mountains and valleys and forget just exactly where you came in. And you've got to scrape and claw your way out of madness, or at least that's how it was for me. But it's just, how does it work in a universe where, you know, 20 years ago, or when I'm reading this for the first time, it's so esoteric, it's so hidden, it's not, you could never mention to someone 20 years ago, hey, you think the world's going to end in 2012 and actually have a conversation? You just get, you know, cross eyes. But then now it's in movies, it's in books, it's mainstream. It just, the comic nature of it at least finally reveals itself, and you can at least relax yourself with a good laugh about it all. That to me is the beautiful thing about it. And I don't know how Terrence McKenna would how he would feel. I bet he would love the world that we live in right now. And you can't say, well, there's people starving, there's people dying, there's wars. Well, all that shit was happening 20 years ago and happening 100 years ago. So you can't use that argument. I
think McKenna was very aware of the downside. Like, you know, I've heard him say, you know, mankind doesn't take to the stars, you know, calmly. It, you know, there's this kicking and screaming explosion into the future where, you know, it has to be because there's war and strife and all the things that we're trying to get over that it sort of accelerates a leap for us. He's like, if everything's, you know, sort of fine and stagnant, then you don't have, you know, it's just human nature. There's no real need to jump ahead. There's nothing to overcome.
Well, also, how naive do you have to be to think that war will ever go away? It's just the amount of volume that that war has. So each one of us has a war within ourselves going on constantly, and the power struggle shifts left and right, up and down, and we have someone in our life that we're at war with, and that's just always going to be there. But the volume to which war escalates, you have to ask yourself, I mean, was there ever a war as loud as World War II? I don't think there really was. I think that's the one, right? That, I mean, these last few wars, I mean, even Vietnam, it never reached the volume of World War II. And if
it did in terms of deaths. Yeah, I mean, there's more. Wasn't there, like, I forget what the numbers are, but yeah, it was a lot of deaths in Vietnam. I mean, you just...
200,000. Do you discount the 200,000 that died in Japan as part of the total numbers of World War II?
Right. See, but the war was over when we bombed Japan, right?
Well, it ended.
That was the
thing. It ended. Yeah. But
no, it was ended, dude. That was the thing. I've had, like, women in their 80s telling me that it was over. Like, the war was over, and they fucking dropped it anyway. Because they wanted to see it, you know? For real.
Yeah, well, I mean, you look at the guys responsible for setting up the bomb and just the public speaking about it and Oppenheimer and whatever. And they're not guys you want at your birthday party. I also don't know if you should trust them. I don't know. Almost irrelevant note, but I'm just noting the character of those cats.
Right.
But so
you wouldn't want them at your birthday party? I think that would be a really interesting birthday party.
Well, like, if I could have Oppenheimer walk in with just no blood running through his body like he usually looks, and just to kind of startle everyone and start talking about, in the most cryptic language possible, the Bhagavad Gita. I mean, you know, I'm down, but I think I'd still be calling those birthday G.I. Joes to just dress up and come over with some toy guns and serve me my cake or something. I'm not in all it. Call a clown instead with some piñatas. At least candy will come from it. And not scared children.
You gotta be careful. Sometimes clowns turn into giant three-horned demons.
Yeah, I don't trust them either. I was just trying to move into a normal stereotype of what's supposed to be a kid's party. But, of course, as already stated, embarrassingly enough, I would have G.I. Joe. So.
I think it would be so funny if Oppenheimer shows up at your birthday party and you just start singing, "We want He-Man, we want He-Man."
would he gain sadness, or would he just continue on the path he is? That's the question.
I heard he was a pretty likable guy in person, you know. Somebody wrote a book recently. I was looking at explanations of this, someone's experiences with Oppenheimer in Los Alamos, and they were just like, oh yeah, no, he was very, like, he was motivating, but he was a really positive guy. I was like, wow, okay, that's weird. Stay positive, guys. We're doing something really...
Maybe he is a party, and he's trying to keep it under wraps.
Okay, I was just thinking about this. Me and Steve Wilner were standing at Burning Man looking at this fucking thing. I just put a connection to it. Somebody, like, these people made this giant fucking thing that says ego, and they used like this is these are all what do you call it, molds that they made gold, right? But it's like there's like if you go super close into it, I don't know if you can hear, but it's like there's guns and Jesus and bones and babies being born and Mother Mary and everything. Like, I don't know if you guys are looking at that, but yes. Fucking crazy. Holy shit, that's me and Amy. That is me and Amy.
Yes, it is.
This is a coincidence. I went to fucking Insta and I fucking look, oh my God, I didn't know someone took our picture. What a fucking trip. Wow, I guess I'll bookmark that.
That's so funny. It's like, I've seen those two people.
I just thought of it in relationship to what everything we've been talking about and how potent of a thing this is, and I decided to do an image search, but wow.
So you realize with you and Amy standing there blocking off the bottom part of the E, it just says, Fuggo.
Oh, crazy. I shouldn't be surprised at these kind of things anymore, but somehow I tend to be. I'm just like, wow, that looks like my bike. Oh, wait a minute. That's me on it. All right.
David, you trying to bring back the high white socks?
Yeah, the tube socks.
Dude, I've been like, wearing socks since, you know, they went out, which I don't know if they ever did.
That's real shit. I decided 3 days ago I was going to bring them back because I've been trying to walk out. I don't go outside my house. One time I left, but I, you know, shorts with the white socks. Just seeing how it goes.
I did that for my last birthday. Me and my twin sister had an 80s themed birthday, and I put on the tube socks with the colored stripes and the little,
yeah,
like Adidas shorts.
We didn't get a sock hops when I was a kid. I mean, there were sock hops in churches, but we didn't understand. So, like, dudes would dress up, like, you know, trying to get laid. Ladies would dress up looking nice. We just have, like, three layers of soccer socks that we were ready to slide around in for a party. Nobody knew how we misinterpreted it that bad. It's good times.
All right.
All right, enough looking at your socks.
Just looking at your socks.
Everybody staring at them socks.
All right, so here, I'm going to throw something at you. I've mentioned this on Always Record before, but you were talking about Oppenheimer and the Bhagavad Gita. So here's right. Something that it just occurred to me, a correlation. I've mentioned before that Oppenheimer famously says, "I am become death," right? Which he's supposed to be quoting the Bhagavad Gita. But right. Actually, the proper translation, the modern translation, is not death, but time.
Right.
So Oppenheimer is essentially saying, "I am become time." Now, I've discussed the implications of that a number of times, but what
that's
I just...
the same thing, though.
Yeah, but what I've just realized, though, is what does Einstein say? If I had known, I would have become a watchmaker.
Whoa. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting that like, you know, when we... I correlate this with this sort of... you know, we want to look at this as time wave zero or a sort of end of time, like all these different, you know, not literal meaning on that, obviously, but something to this. Is this the end of that time loop? Is this, is you know, what is this essentially saying? But this idea that, I don't know, I just had to throw that out there. I realized that I would have become a watchmaker. You know, Einstein saying about the atomic bomb that he would have become a watchmaker, and Oppenheimer saying, "I am become time." What is this saying for that moment? I don't know. Throwing it out there.
Well, I just think that in the stream of information on the internet, there is no tomorrow. There is no waiting for tomorrow. I mean, if you're contacting someone on the other side of the earth, it is their tomorrow. I mean, there is no... The information, the human information can engage in itself with itself 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every day of the year. Well, then you don't have a day, you don't have an hour, you don't have a minute. You just, it's that constant flow of information. And so where does time, does it have a place in that flow of information? I don't know that it does. And I don't know that we've ever really connected the network to that level ever. I mean, tribally you could, where everyone in the tribe can be in the same moment continuously, but we don't live in tribes anymore. I mean, the last time, I mean, that's what The Shining is all about, right? I mean, those three people are trapped inside the grid in a nuclear family, and they rip each other to pieces. They go crazy because the information is so limited, so finite. If that makes any sense.
Yeah. It's interesting to think of the Shining, the Overlook Hotel, as a sort of bomb shelter. You know, that sort of idea of nuclear winter outside, and they're just stuck in the shelter. And so they have plenty of food and canned goods to get them through it. It sort of is a post-apocalyptic vision.
Well, when they go outside... Yeah. What you got, Dave?
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, when they go outside the first time, there's like a voice that doesn't even seem like it's coming from a character, but it's definitely the mom's voice saying, like, who's going to clean up America?
Yeah, which I think is a reference to Iron Eyes Cody. You know about that? So in the 70s, that Indian who's the crying Indian who's like basically cleaning up America because she's like basically chasing into the labyrinth. So she's following Danny and her are racing, and she's like, loser has to clean up America. So the place itself is built on an Indian burial ground, and they had to fend off several Indian attacks. And it's decorated with this whole Indian motif. So it's like, it's like a fucked up joke on basically Iron Eyes Cody being the loser, you know.
That is crazy.
And then she lets him win, right? Isn't that the deal?
I forgot.
She's like, she's just like, oh, okay, all right. Yep.
The Iron Eyes Cody, the one with the tear in his eye at the end of the commercial, that's a white actor.
Right, which is the funny part, too. Yeah, no, totally. That's so weird.
And who would call a man famous for crying on TV Iron Eyes?
Right.
He would be Rusty Eyes by that
time. I'm sure that it's because it's Cody and it's like got code in there, and it's like Stanley Kubrick's trying to reveal the code to us, you know? It's like, I'm sure.
Ironsides was a famous ship, and then the code break exactly.
Michael Ironside plays a villain in almost everything ever that has significant resonance.
Has he ever played someone named Cody?
I'm going to go back through 3 Lundgren movies, 10 Van Damme movies, and the other 400, and 3 Highlanders, and I'll give you a response.
Oh, I would never submit anyone to that. Please don't. Not on my account.
I do it anyway. It's my schedule.
Hold on. I'm doing some random... Oh, okay. I was thinking of Bill Cody or whatever, Buffalo Bill. Like some sort of...
Oh, yeah.
That came up last night. So I was talking... So Howdy Doody, right? Last night I was talking about Captain Howdy from The Exorcist and how Captain Howdy is the name of the Satan in the attic. But then I realized that Max von Sydow is the guy who is the Exorcist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to be in a new movie. Is it Branded or whatever, I think?
Yeah.
So that's Max von Sydow. But then Max von Sydow gets rid of Satan in that movie, but then he is Satan in Needful Things. Stephen King's Needful Things,
right?
Which is kind of funny. There's a bunch of synchronicity around that movie, but the whole thing with that is Captain Howdy in the attic, and then I was thinking Howdy Doody, and Howdy Doody is a wooden doll, which kind of reminds me of Pinocchio. And then I was thinking of that the guy who controlled Howdy Doody, his name was went by Buffalo Bob, which was a reference to Buffalo Bill. And I was thinking of Silence of the Lambs, how the guy takes human skin and basically to make a human suit. And in a way, he's like trying to inseminate something dead with life. is the whole idea there in a really weird, twisted kind of way. But this whole idea has been coming a lot with The Shining as basically being inspired by Freud's The Uncanny, which is about, a lot of it is about inseminating like dolls or like toys or something that's not real with life. Why it is that we have the energetic response that we do of fear in relationship to something that's not supposed to be animated being animated, and how that was the whole connection with Toy Story. Like Toy Story has all the Shining references in it, and supposedly, you know, I mean, this is a connection that I was looking at, was the idea that Toy Story is basically just that. And so there's this weird thing, like the ball rolls towards Danny from room 237, and why is that so fucking scary, you know, because it's like it has life, but where does it get it, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I was contemplating all of that, and Howdy Doody with Buffalo Bill is definitely something interesting in terms of Captain Howdy in the attic from The Exorcist.
Just an aside, quick side note. Anyone notice that in the DVD versions of The Shining, the tennis ball, when it rolls to Danny, it's a regular yellow tennis ball. But if you download the movie for iTunes, in that scene, the tennis ball is pink.
Huh. Interesting.
I just wanted to throw that out there, see if anybody noticed that. It's just an odd... How the fuck does that happen? Whatever. Put it in the X-Files.
Like George Lucas went back and, you know, changed the... Han doesn't shoot first anymore, and the ball's pink now.
Is it a reference to the pink phallus laser?
Well, isn't that where your mind went? I mean, that's where my mind went. But it's just so fucking subtle and so strange and such an anomaly that how would the transfer of the print from wherever they got it from into the downloaded version, it's just the only anomaly in that movie. It's whatever.
It's a very significant scene in the movie because it's the one that people take at the Apollo launch, because when Danny stands up with his Apollo sweater, it gives the appearance of the launch, and then he goes to room 237 right after that and gets his sweater torn, you know, and apparently strangled, you know.
Yeah.
Go ahead. No, that was it.
Well, no, because it's the sun. The sun rolls up, and it's in the center of the universe, and the kid is surrounded by trucks and little land machines, and he rises up as the rocket and realizes he's not constrained by any forces. He can go wherever he wants to go. But in this updated, downloaded version, it's not the yellow sun in the middle, or the, you know, the thing that sort of gives him freedom. It's this, I don't know. It, you can read a lot into something that is possibly just an accident, but maybe that's, you know, the high weirdness working its magic, you know.
Trevor, what were you gonna say?
I was just gonna agree with what he said about Danny referencing the Apollo mission, because a while ago I was about to bring up, like, how then Jay Widener said that The Shining was essentially like a code for, well, or Stanley Kubrick describing sort of how he was involved in the staged moon mission. So, yeah, I kind of wonder what the pink ball would be in that context.
And Widener goes to the extent of saying that the octagons they're playing on, that's identical to the back of David's blog, is supposed to be the whole layout of the, you know, where the crafts, the liftoff stage and the various trucks around it, as discussed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all of it's all archetypal at the same time, and so you can go in any direction with it, and it allows for that, because these are universal things. Those are octagons, you know. It couldn't be more perfect. And Apollo, the fucking god Apollo, like, that's, you know, the eagle has landed, and then you have the whole birth of tragedy. I mean, like, I feel like The Shining, it could be called a modern Greek tragedy on, like, multiple levels. Like, it's Dan's Labyrinth, you know, like, He lures his father in there, and it's so Oedipal, the way he, like, runs to his mom at the end. It's like, you know, he kills the father and fucks the mother, basically. Like,
oh, that's weird. David, you know, in Kevin Halcott's Sync Book chapter, he mentions that the word tragedy means goat song.
It means what?
Goat song.
Goat shit.
So if it's Dan's Labyrinth or Pan's Labyrinth, that's perfect.
Wow. Yeah, it didn't occur to me. Wow, that's weird. Yeah, no, that's, I do I have a synchronicity video of The Doors, the end, along with the end of The Shining. And it's weird because the timing that it landed on, that I play it at, is the exact timing which three albums before it ended. So I play three albums and then I play the end. And it just so happens that it ends like right at the end. Like, it's weird. Like, I don't know. Yeah. Goat song. I wanna cross reference that. That's crazy. Yeah, he goat song. It's from Greek. Wow, crazy, because there's the Satyr chorus in Greek tragedy, and the Satyr chorus are basically like goat people, right? And they sing along, like, they basically would drown out the actors. It's like everyone was familiar with the plays, and then you have these people communicating with the audience, the whole subtext and subplot of the story, dressed as, like, goats. So that makes a lot of sense. That's weird. Okay. The other thing I thought was weird is I was looking at the actual stage, what do you call it, the theatron, like, the old Greek stage. Like, if you look at the layout from above, like, it's totally the exact layout of Burning Man. Like, the way that
Burning Man
is, like, that kind of tripped me out, too. I was like, wow, it's like a crazy Greek stage.
Like an amphitheater, like a half circle.
Yeah, kind of thing. That circle thing, which also reminds me of this, like, you know, the beginning of 2001 with the crescent, you know, it's like kind of got a crescent quality to it. Or the head dress of the woman in Metropolis, who's a horror of Babylon, you know, like, it reminds me of that. Lady Gaga had that too, but Lady Gaga is named after Radio Gaga, which is about Metropolis. So it's weird.
Me?
Yeah, and the Colorado flag, totally. I see.
Yeah, it's like got two blue stripes and then a red C being parted by a yellow ball.
Wow.
Like the sun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's in the games room, right? The Colorado flag and the Shining. Right before he sees the two towers.
So where are we with Apocalypse, Alan? Where how we started this whole thing?
Maybe wasn't Alan. Danny bombing the universe?
Yes.
Isn't that what Jack said? You done blowing up the universe or whatever? Something like
oh,
that.
Yeah, totally.
I don't know how many avid Lost fans there are out there. Was that a show you guys kept touch with?
Oh yeah, I watched it.
Yeah.
Did you notice the whole Shining storyline threaded through there? I didn't catch it the first time, but
yeah, somewhat.
Somewhat.
Yeah.
It starts really with I just started noticing it with the character of Miles, who they show with his mother in a motel complex, and his father is dead. And the kid can talk to dead people. And he stares at a door in this motel complex with fear, because he can sense that something's going on within that room. So you have Danny escaped from the Overlook Hotel, now living with his mom, a dark-haired woman who's dying at a motel, and he's surrounded by all these doors with stories behind him. And then you flash over to the island, and you have Doc, which is Jack Shepard, who is struggling with essentially the same kind of mystery, and the character who is revealed in the next kind of step to seemingly have some of the answers is Dan Faraday. So you go from Miles to Doc to Dan. And Dan is sort of like Danny, who has spent all his life trying to translate just exactly what the mystery of Room 237 is, but he's boiled it down into quantum physics and space and time travel. And it's just fucking obvious. I mean, it's just threaded in there. And then there's a scene where a character is bouncing a tennis ball in this room, and I'm thinking, fuck, there it is, right there. And a guy opens the door and goes, I hope you're not going all Nicholson on us. He goes, what do you mean? You know when he bounces the tennis ball in The Shining?
I posted that picture, but I was wondering what that was about.
So it's kind of like, especially with that show, it wasn't until it was dead that I could start to pick it apart more accurately, because I wasn't sort of committed to the linear episode 1, 2, 3, 4 and watching it all in order. Now that the show is finished and like the ending point is closed, it's only now that you truly see the architecture that reveals that the last episode wasn't the end of that show. It's certainly not the end of that narrative, especially to the viewer. You've got to go kind of like the way the show represents. You got to hop around in time with that show. You got to watch an episode from season 2 and then watch an episode from season 5. And when you kind of hop around within that narrative, the architecture starts to reveal itself and you can kind of put everything in its place. And you kind of see exactly the structure that those writers built. And this is all we do with a movie like The Shining, and especially with like John Fell Ryan's very explicit taking, you know, every cigarette in the movie, trying to recreate the architecture of the hallways. It's something that you can't do in the initial viewing, but you can do it once it's dead, meaning that it's lived its life and now it's sort of preserved.
It's like 9/11, right? Going back and looking at all the sinks.
Exactly. And this show Lost, I mean, it's all in there as far as like a sink culture thing. I mean, I knew it was in there, but going back now and watching it, it's blowing my mind just how explicit it is. Like there's a scene with Hurley. He's in a car and he overhears some people imprinting a number on a piece of metal. And as they're going down the string of numbers, he's attracted to it because he knows those numbers. Those are the numbers that have haunted him all his life. And you can tell mentally he's following along. And then they say the second to last number, 23, he finally speaks and completes the next number before it's imprinted. And he goes, 42. Now, that number didn't have as much of an impact on me back then when I saw the show live. But now when I'm going back and having spent all this time in this literature and all the detective work that's out there on the internet, I mean, these guys were right on top of it. I mean, it would be impossible to say that they weren't. And I kind of think right now, like, someone like Christopher Knowles, who completely blew my mind apart with his exegesis of the X-Files, you know, that's a show that I thought I understood, but I understood it from a very individual, egocentric sort of way. But then when I read his articles and how he goes back and reinterprets them and unfolds them and shows the larger architecture at play, I was like, God, I didn't even see that fucking show, you know? It just sort of passed by me in a blur, and I was entertained by it, but I certainly didn't know what was going on. And I'm wondering if and when someone will do that with Lost. I mean, I know Lost happened in the heart of internet culture, so there are probably 1,000 message boards that have deconstructed it and picked it apart and have written down most of the things that have been needed to be said. But I think Lost, like The X-Files, and much like The Shining, is that as that work of art exists, it starts to incorporate things that haven't happened yet, so that you can see it attracts and embeds events that happened after it was created, because it's constructed in that kind of way. And I don't know if necessarily Kubrick was the one who invented that. Maybe he just perfected it, or maybe he just had the spotlight on him. But I think to see that Shining storyline so explicit in Lost is their sort of saying, hey, you know, we didn't build this originally. We're just sort of improving upon an established model. I think that's why you see the book Ulysses in Lost, and I think that's why you see the book Valis in Lost. And especially with Valis, when John Locke says, I think you need to read this again.
Hey, Billy, break it up again.
All right. But it's Hello? Really, yeah.
Completely cutting out.
All right, can you hear? Can you hear me now?
That sounds much better, yes.
Just really to wrap up.
We can
up,
hear you, Kevin Howdy.
Just really to wrap up that sort
so
of.
So I guess the question you have to figure out is, if Toy Story uses so much material from The Shining and Lost uses a lot of material from The Shining, what are the correlations between Toy Story and Lost?
Well, no. No, it's this. It's when John let me just try to finish
screen
this
memory
thought.
And psychosis has a lot to do with 23 and the Truman Show, and the people who pay attention to patterns will wind up going insane.
Well, let me just finish this thought, is that when Locke says to the character with the book Valis, he says, I think you need to read this again. It's kind of like a show like Lost. I think you need to watch the show again. You need to start over from the beginning and rewatch the entire narrative, much like The Shining. If you think you walked out of the theater the first time you saw that movie, you haven't seen anything yet. It's only on multiple viewings that you get that penetrative vision of what's going on there. I mean, it's all unconscious material. And I think that's what Psychosis and Madness is all about, is that it allows you to review your own life. You know, you kind of, you can't know what a life is about until you relive it.